just want to do a PSA for all the people who pour coffee out there. I get it. You think you should be tipped 80% or whatever to pour the coffee. Yeah, I know Austin would tip them. I did the... I'm starting a revolution in the city.
What's the revolution?
The hitting that no tip button on the pads.
Is that really the hill you want to die on?
Yes.
It's a bad revolution.
No, it's a good one. It's a good revolution. Server, they wouldn't have poured a drink for you. Like, they wouldn't be working. Server, of course. Like, that is industry standard. Mm-hmm. Make sure that the people in the back are getting tipped out because they're grinding for you in the hot kitchen. I wish that things were a little different, that we weren't always passing on to customer. But, no, if I go for luxury baked goods, I've made this point before, or if I go for coffees and I buy two coffees, mm-hmm. you know, and it's me and the person I'm with, and I decide to treat them to one, and the bill comes to $8, I'm not tipping you on top of that. I'm buying, I'm doing a good thing already by supporting local business and paying you way over the top for some beans. Sometimes, too.
Bean juice.
Sometimes these shops that trade in purely coffee, not as good as the big box stores that I get my coffee from every morning. But those people, please, for love of God, at those places, the big box places, can we just fill the coffee 96%? Do we have to put it all the way to the top? Mm-hmm. Please. I'm just so tired of getting coffee splashes.
So coming out of the
on my sleeves, on my shirts. It's just, it's enough is enough. Mm-hmm. And so maybe if they start at those establishments, and that's the other part of why I hate it, is because you go to a place like that and they're grinding. They're filling like a million coffees and people are all there like, hurry up. I've got to go to work. It's like, okay. And they would never consider tipping them. I made this point before. Then why, if everyone thinks tipping is great and you're saying, JD, you're a monster, let me see your Uber Eats. Mm. Open up your phone, show me what you tip on Uber Eats. And if it's a healthy 15% on all your orders plus, then you can judge away.
Then and only then.
Yes, but then if you go under, you are dead to me.
You're a 10%? You have no leg to
stand. You're a you're doing it for yourself. You're not doing it for the other person. You're tipping to be like, look at me. And guess what? Nobody's looking at what buttons you're pressing. Like, they're just not. Other than the server, who you need to just get past the guilt. Anyways, please stop coffee bombing me, as our friend Sam McKee calls it, where it's everywhere. And the same thing today. It completely threw off my day. Ben Ennis. You're staring at me like I owe you something. Like you
no, think. I'm staring at you because honestly, I can't get over the idea of a $4 coffee.
It's, yeah, I know. It's outrageous.
Twice as much as I'd like to pay for a coffee.
That's more than twice as much as I'd like to pay for a coffee. But every once in a while, sure. You like to treat yourself and you go into the city. And that's one of the... I love how that's one of the perks of living in the city is you get to overpay for things that actually are not usually that spectacular. Either that's a bar, a restaurant, or a coffee shop. But it's nice.
No, the perk of the burbs is, there's no pretension in that our coffee is normally priced, right? Like, we're not frou-frou in the fifth largest city in North America.
They're always
we go to the Costco and we ask for a coffee with our $1 hot dog.
Blue collar guys and gals just, grinding away in old
at the
mines, the old mines of Oakville. Going underground every day, putting your helmets on,
making sure
that your lights in the helmets have batteries, and then kissing your significant other saying, I hope I come home today in one piece.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, Oakville. Oh, man. Mining town. Little known fact.
That's
anyways,
right.
What's up, buddy? How are we doing today?
I'm all right.
I'm going to start with one of our hobby horses, obviously, right?
What's that?
Right.
I thought, what?
Refereeing.
What? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and how it's easy. How it's the easiest thing to do. Although, okay, I'm kind of torn on this one. Have you seen the report? The reports are kind of torn. Some people are trying to do the lip reading thing like John Boy, but I don't think that's overly effective. For those of you that don't know, the Raptors lost last night. They were winning basically all game long. I think they started to choke and melt down once the whistle started to go a little bit against them. And in kind of classic fashion, it's a top-down thing where their head coach is turning into a tomato on every single play on the sideline, just freaking out.
He's a cartoon character.
Dude, it's too much. I don't know why people think this is good or why anyone would think that comportment is good. You have to have Anyway, I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but to me, the coach balance that you want to have with the officials is use your bullets wisely, like pick your battles just a little bit. With Nick Nurse, it's just the entire game, every single call, he's up in the official's face, and at the end of it, he's just tomato. Like, he's fully red, he's screaming at the official, and what do you think that does for the players? They're going, yeah, look, that's our coach. That's our guy on the sideline, and he's saying that we're getting screwed over, so of course.
It's acceptable behavior, right? Like, it's like when my wife is always around my kids using her phone looking at screens. You know, they're like, oh, that's acceptable behavior to be on our iPads for 20 hours a day.
In a public space, eh? Like, Ben, hey, let it be known, Ben Ennis is never looking at his screens. It's never him that does it. It's only his wife. Wow, that was a real passive-aggressive shot. Anyways, some people think Scotty Barnes said nothing. Some people, the official, Scott Foster, who, tough to defend Scott Foster, given his track record. I don't want to be the person that goes out here and says, you know what, Scott was good there. But there are some people saying Scotty Barnes said, hold on, let me pull it up exactly. It's some version of y'all cheating us, which, you know, not great in today's era.
What?
Yeah, but y'all, some people, it's been, again, this is just, according to some reports, is that he said, y'all are cheating, bro.
Oh, cheating, bro, is different than cheating us, honestly.
Yeah.
Because cheating us is like, hey, you're not giving us a fair chance. Like, cheating, bro, is like, oh, yeah, you're doing something untoward. You are actually actively, you know, on the take. You are making the incorrect calls.
I think once you say cheating, though, around the official in a late game situation like that, you are running that risk. And that's pretty immature if that is the case. If he didn't say it, this is such a weird one, because if he just said anything other than that, like anything other than what Scott Foster claims, which is taking a shot at the credibility or the integrity of the officiating crew, you just can't make that call.
No. And honestly, even if he did say that, like, let's just...
No. That actually is where this is what I wanted to bring
you're
up to
within
today.
You're within the realm of acceptable behavior to eject the player at that time. But also, like, going back to the multitude of conversations we've had about officials, like, just take the screaming in your face, right?
Yes.
Like, just turn the other cheek if you are the official in a close game, right? Like, in a highly competitive, intense basketball game in the dying minute of the basketball game.
Yeah.
Like, I think you can turn a... You can
Not
pretend you didn't hear it. You can
Not
pretend you didn't hear it.
I don't think to that. Because here's the thing. I legitimately, on this show, had Joe Bo... My boy Josiah Bosch, who's sitting across from me, he genuinely thought the Arian Foster thing was real.
Yeah.
Like, he thought that was real. Like, he did. He sent that email, and he was like, guys, you see his story? I knew that the NFL had some suspicious stuff. And then he writes an email, he's like, but fully rigged, fully scripts? Every single time there's someone tweeting about the script, Joe shares it. Like, still to this day. Like, he'll send it, and, like, Le'Veon Bell said that the Jake Paul thing was scripted, whatever. In the era of sports betting and in the era of dumb young people like Joe on the internet, where you could turn on your mic and you finish stuff, but it's just like, it's... because you deserve it.
We don't have to cater to the dumbos.
I know.
The dumbos will always be there.
No, I think that you as a league, you absolutely need to make sure. And dude, Scott Foster, let's not forget, he's the ref that was buddies with Tim Donaghy. He's the guy that everybody, like Tim Donaghy called him... Every single day. Not like, oh, hey, I'll catch up with you down the line. Every single day, those two guys talked on the phone. So I can understand a hypersensitivity to that if that is the case. If you use the words, you're cheating us, or y'all are cheating,
bro. No, you're cheating us cheating us is fine.
Fine, whatever. If you're bringing that up, I actually think that that's the one area. I would be less... concerned if Scotty Barnes started like personally attacking Scott Foster in just vicious ways using really rude language. I would say, yeah, you know what, Scott? Eat it. That's what your job is. You're the ref. But if you start doing the you're cheating thing, I kind of get it. Especially for NBA officials.
Maybe Scotty was just playing to his fan base, right? Because the Raptors love to put on the tinfoil hats and
say Scotty is a big crybaby when it comes to the officials, man. Again, for a second-year player, like, he really, like, it's a lot sometimes from him. A disturbing amount for a guy his age. And especially when he first came to the team, it was a lot of, hey, this guy is heart and soul, wants to do everything to win. He's just a great positive energy guy. And it's just a lot of complaining. And even when he was getting ejected, he was doing the who, me? And then... the pointing back at Scott Foster, I went, ooh, that's kind of trouble. What are we doing with that part of it? Anyway, I wish they would just complain less, the Raptors. They remind me of the 2015 Jays, except for they're not good.
Yeah. No, it's a good comparison. Yeah, with the Jose Bautista and the Josh Donaldson. But yeah, Jose Bautista actually made every correct call, right?
Yeah.
He would have been the world's greatest umpire.
Oh, my God. We still, that was one of our first bits. Like, who would be the greatest umpire on earth? Jose Bautista.
Yeah, his second career would be tremendous as an umpire. I think you're
Turns
you're right,
out when
though,
you to... get just like millions and millions and millions of dollars, you don't need to stand behind home plate for 162 and get berated.
No, you like to show up and be feted, which you will in August. But I think you're right to talk about the Nick Nurse of it all, right?
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, especially for a player who's only known one head coach in the NBA, and that's Nick Nurse. I mean, a couple other guys have as well. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a little different for Fred VanVleet, who's been in the league a little bit longer than Scotty Barnes, who's in his second tour of duty. Yeah, that like Nick. I remember the early days of like the Nick Nurse memeability and thinking, man, we really got to capture this because he's never going to be this animated again, except it happens like on a nightly basis. Like there's like 10 memes a game that come out of that dude.
So the Raptors, in games that are within 3 points, are 4-10. And last night was just another example of them being a close game that they let fritter away. And I think it's a multitude of different reasons. Like, this is a really good basketball team, man. I enjoyed a lot of that game, right? They can hang with just about anybody when they're at their best. OG Anunoby did this incredible job of locking up Jokic, where, did you notice Jokic was the MVP in that game? He did a lot of, hey, I'm throwing one-handed passes on inbounds. That was cool. That was like the highlights of the game for him. He made a couple of nice dimes. He hit one big shot in the first half. But for the most part, OG just basically bottled him up, kept him completely quiet. Jakob Poeltl was going at him, and they were really exposing him. Gary Trent Jr. was hitting shots. Siakam kind of had a bad game. Scotty Barnes was getting his spot at times. Just Fred VanVleet was brilliant. Raptors are a good basketball team, but when they get in the crunch, I do think that there's two things that are wrong with the team. One is that they still don't really have that elite crunch time guy, and we want Siakam to be that so badly. Good player, but when the game gets tight, I don't necessarily trust him to be consistently great in those spots. And two is, I think that there is something to their composure, their maturity level. They let their emotions get really, really high in a lot of those games. And I know other teams do too. This is not a problem that's just like exclusive to the Raptors. But I do wonder with a group like that where you have Fred VanVleet, you have OG, you have Pascal Siakam, you have Gary Trent Jr., who's been in the league for a really long time. You have Nick Nurse, who's a championship-winning coach. How much I'm supposed to put of this on the rookie Scotty Barnes? Like, it just, I don't know how quantifiable this is or what you're supposed to do about it or how you handle it or how it goes into the way that you evaluate going into next year. Because I think the natural thing is to look at it and go, a lot of this is bad luck, right? We do with shooting percentages. When a guy is not shooting well, you go, well, it's probably going to have some regression to the mean. The Raptors are probably going to have some regression to the mean in these closer games. I'm not particularly sure that's the right assessment.
I would say, well, you know, it's weird because, yeah, they have this horrible record in close games at the end. And I think you're right to point out Pascal Siakam not looking like Kevin Durant down the stretch, because nobody does. But this is,
he had a bad game.
Isolation scoring in tight ball games against good teams, probably not where Pascal Siakam's at his best. It's really interesting to look at the Scotty Barnes crunch time numbers, though, right? And how spectacular they are.
I know.
And whether that's the result of Siakam being the primary offensive weapon down the stretch and him, you know, not getting the primary defender, but might be time to start looking at more Scotty Barnes down the stretch. It would have been nice to see him yesterday finish the game, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, ejected. So yesterday was not a good case study for this. But, I mean, let's try and extrapolate those, I guess, limited sample crunch time moments for Scotty Barnes. And I mean, you got to try something else because it's been now a season-long theme being unable to finish these games. Let's see Scotty Barnes getting the late-game opportunity.
I think he's gotten a lot. But this brings me to the main point, which is I love refs. I'm growing to appreciate refs in this way. So it's the righteous indignation. It's the righteous anger that we get as sports fans watching officials do this. And I get that when it's a massive game and things haunt you forever and these random moments like Ben Revere, right, where he gets completely screwed on a strike zone. Do you know, I learned that, I think it was a study I heard it on the 99% Invisible podcast. Umpires miss 14 calls on average a game. 14, which yeah. I thought that sounds like a really big number. The thing is that when they brought in the robot umps to all these other leagues, they're finding that it's really, really hard because the players and the coaches and everybody's agreeing that the strike zone isn't really working when they set it to the right parameters. And so actually what they've done to adjust it is have the strike zone expanded by, I don't know, a few centimeters, an inch off the plate, actually, to make sure that the strike zone is a little bit bigger than the perfect exact strike zone that it's supposed to be called according to the letter of the law, right? So even the robot umpire stuff, like, it's not perfect. It doesn't seem to work, but there's no righteous anger to a robot. And all I keep thinking with these officials is last night was a really fun game. And yeah, the Raptors, I think, kind of frittered it away. And I had some problems with the way that they played down the stretch. I didn't think that their coaching was particularly good. I didn't think that they had a lot of composure. Sure, did a couple of calls go against them? Yeah, I would say that the off-ball foul was the worst one, where it was Jokic versus, I think, Barnes or OG, where he's trying to cut into the middle of the floor and they call an off-ball foul with like a minute left. And I go, come on, that's a bad one. The rest of them, I really didn't have a big issue with. Either way, point is, if you're a Raptors fan, you got to have this really entertaining game. And at the end of it, you feel cheated. And I think that's good. I don't think that's a bad thing. You watched that Raptors game last night to get away from it all, to be able to focus in on you, away from your problems for just a few hours. Try to disconnect, try to do whatever. Your wife, you know, get her off her screens that she's so obsessed with the entire time. And I think you got that. I kind of think as a sports fan, that's not the perfect game. The perfect game ends with a player deciding it in spectacular fashion and your team winning. But I accept that being angry and being furious at Scott Foster and having a villain, that has a value to it. Like, I enjoyed it.
You want an excuse. You don't want to lose on merit. God, no. You want, John Tavares' goal to be negated because of an interference call that was incorrectly called.
If you're going to lose, I'd much rather have that, where you get to be angry with people over the officials. Like, there is something kind of, I don't know if it's comforting, whatever the hell the word is, but there is something nice about saying I'm mad about Ben Revere's strike zone call, and every Blue Jays fan goes, yeah, I'm with you. Like, that's a shame.
Because then you don't get to talk about the fact that,
I don't want to talk about the fact.
They were trailing the game before that.
I don't want to talk about that.
They were, like, on merit being, beaten.
Losing.
And that was also game six. And even if you come back and tie the game, which is all we're talking about, Pompey scoring from third base,
again,
doesn't mean you win that game.
And
even if you win that game, doesn't mean you win game seven. Yeah. Instead of having those conversations, you can have a conversation about a strike call that was a foot off the plate. That's much better.
Yeah.
Or you can talk about this Raptors team that's like in the play-in, but hey, man, look at all the close games that they've had and how poorly they've been officiated against. And you can go down the NBA Illuminati wormhole of the worst officials in the league being assigned to Raptors games. You can have that talking point instead of holy crap, this is a team that had an opportunity to really remake itself at the trade deadline, chose not to because they thought they were much better than they are.
By the way, one of my favorite Toronto things, I'm so glad that you said this because I really wanted to bring it up, is that Raptors and Blue Jays fans feel as though the league is against them because they are the other, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're the other. And hey, the league doesn't care because they don't get the Toronto television ratings the same way. They don't translate well to ESPN. Get them out of here. You know, nobody wants the Toronto Raptors to be champions. So rig it against them. And yet for the Maple Leafs fans, they feel because they're the center of the universe that the NHL and its officials need to actually buck the other way order to maintain some level of plausible deniability with their inherent bias that the refs are against them too. And it's great. It's like, what kind of a team would Toronto
Ontario
have to field
especially.
For? Yeah, what type of team would Toronto have to have for people here to feel as though the refs are not against? I actually think that maybe I'm wrong. I should ask this to other people. I think everybody thinks the refs are against them, much like everybody thinks that announcers hate their team. Like, it's a commonly held sports trope.
Buddy, until you win. Yeah. No, that's,
but the Raptors have won. But the Raptors have, that's the thing. The Raptors just won. And you still have people going, it's a conspiracy.
Well, like, because obviously let's never let that happen again. Did you see the ratings for the 2019 finals? It was
weren't
horrible.
They great?
I don't.
Yeah.
Weren't they? I can't imagine they were great.
I don't know. I thought they were pretty good. Anyway, they were. Maybe I'm just thinking about how great they were here. Anyway, my point is, I wonder if there is something to Toronto just that is a little different because of, yeah, our sporting culture is different and our team setup is different. We're either exactly that, either the center of the universe with the Leafs or the other with the other two franchises. And I wonder how that mix of constantly talking about the officials, whether or not that's just more of a byproduct. I brought this up before with the official talk with you and I, because you and I love this topic. Whether or not that's just a byproduct of now on social media, if you're critical of any player at any time, you really open yourself up to risk. Versus if you're just mad at Scott Foster, you just will. Yeah. It's great. You can.
The Foster family is not on Twitter.
Nope.
I don't think.
Nope. You can say whatever you want on social. It's like there's a few groups that you can just say anything you want about, and officials are at the top of that tier where it's like whatever you want to say. Basically, the only place we draw the line is like a death threat, but even then, people are like, no. They're like, they don't really look into it. Who's looking into it? Anyway, do you think it's anything to do with Toronto? You think I'm onto something? Or do you think it's just a sports fan thing?
I think it's a sports fan thing, right? Because nobody wants to believe that their team actually stinks, right? That anybody lost for real. It's like how there's no guilty people in prison, right? Like, everybody's innocent.
Yeah.
It's not their fault. You know, there's reasons why they're there. No, nobody wants to take accountability. That, okay, maybe it's like a generational issue that nobody wants to just say, hey, you know what? We did our best and we lost because it's always somebody else's fault. Maybe that's where we're at, right? Maybe it's the youths of today.
I'm into blaming the youths. That is another thing I like to do. You're coming to the right guy with this take. Like, I'm going, this guy?
Couldn't be our bad basketball team.
This guy's talking a lot of sense.
You know what? It's the baby boomer
young
referees,
people.
Right? They ruined the planet for us.
Oh, my God.
The sport.
It's the perfect combination. It's the boomers and the Gen Zs combining for a horrible product. Oh, my God. I feel like this is National Treasure or whatever, that Nick Cage movie. I'm putting all the pieces together and I'm solving the riddle. All right, what do you guys think? Is this a Toronto thing or is this a, like, the amount of official talk we do in the city and the lengths people go for the conspiracy and the complaining? Toronto talk, Simon, you've worked in the sports industry for a decade.
I think it's just a sports fan thing.
Okay.
I think and you nailed it too with the announcers. Like, the amount of times you see, like, oh, like, so-and-so hates my team. Mm-hmm. They say it all the time. And, like, I don't know. They're just calling games, especially if it's like a national announcer. Like, they don't hate your team.
I think some announcers do not like some teams, though.
That's definitely true. There's
some that maybe they don't even actually not like the team, but I do think that there are a couple of guys that play it up because that fan base has accused them so many times.
That's the bit now.
Yeah. Mm. Like, I think I've always wondered how much, like, because Leaf fans would get so irate about Jim Houston.
Right.
Like, forever, right? They would be just furious. He hates them. He hates them. He hates them. And I disagreed, obviously, because I think Jim Houston is truly one of the greatest play-by-play men that we've ever seen in that sport. Mm-hmm. And I just think that for him to be the greatest at that job as he is, he needs to have the approach of, I'm going to go in there and be great every single night. But you're telling me there wasn't one or two times in the Leafs games where Huey went, ask me fun. let me just take a little bit of a little underwhelming call for the Leafs or a little over the top for the opposition. And just, yeah, I think that's just human nature. I think that's fun. You don't think that happens, guys?
I think it might have happened when they were playing the Canucks, perhaps. Like, that's like subconsciously.
No, see, that's where you go. That's what everybody thinks. I don't think that's the case. Just from having chatted with the man for a few times, I don't think that is a real thing. All right, fine. I'll abandon my ref thoughts. I will say, though, that the robot umpire thing, learning about that this week really did stick out to me about be careful what you wish for. Because it's in AAA now, and baseball is having a lot of changes to expedite the game. And it feels like more review is coming to baseball in a theater near you, like, very, very soon. And hearing that stuff about the strike zone and the fact that they had to tinker with, I can't remember what the system is called, but to expand the strike zone to make it
feel... ABS, right?
ABS.
Automatic balls and strikes.
I think that's what it is. I thought AVN. I was like, nah, it's a different thing.
True.
That's
different thing.
Yeah, it's a different... That's not for public consumption. Anyways, so... I'm not into the robot umps at all. I know I've said robot umps. I know I've been a big proponent. I think that you should just find a balance between getting the most horrific umpires out and keeping the best ones in, so that we can have that righteous anger and that we can have again, 14 calls a game sounds like a lot, but that's using it as the letter of the law on the strike zone. If we actually look at umpires, I'm going to say it. No, they do a pretty good job, and I'm not sure. I could do better than them. Yeah.
No, I couldn't. No, yeah, I mean, I've always maintained
I could do just as good, and I'm walking it back upon looking at some of the studies.
You're an idiot. No, the best, like.
I wouldn't say idiot. I'd say confident. I'm confident.
Yeah.
Overly confident, perhaps.
No, the best compromise between the two is, like, the challenge automatic strike ball thing, which takes like 2 seconds. You just like touch your helmet, and then the call is either confirmed or reversed.
I just don't like why do we watch sports for everything to be perfectly fair? Like,
I think we should strive for as fair as
you're
possible.
You're a nerd. Who cares?
Who cares what you think?
Who booked this guy?
You did.
Yeah, I know.
You just said, you know, like you're talking about, you know, the excuse making and the potential to eliminate the excuses exists. Why wouldn't we take that opportunity to eliminate excuses?
I don't think we have nothing
to throw at you when their team loses.
I think we want people to be played fairly under the same rules. But outside of that, in terms of like random chances or random acts of fate, whatever, random twists of fate, we should be embracing that as sports fans. We should not be trying to run away from that. And again, we've seen with review, it's like it never really fully works the way that we think it's going to. And I don't think that if an umpire has been calling balls and strikes a certain way all game long, which again, we accept that the strike zone does change at times. And like, we know this for a fact, like there are all these different things done, like sympathetic umpire, all kinds of different stuff that actually impacts the way the game is happening. And sometimes, you've said this before too. Sometimes a ball is a strike. Sometimes a strike is a ball, depending on what the situation is. I actually trust an umpire in a lot of situations to make those ones. The umpires are so good at their job that the screw ups that they make, they stand out so aggressively where we go, holy crap, look at this guy. Let me finish this thought.
Different than a human error. Okay.
Let me finish this thought. If an umpire has been calling a game the entire game this certain way, and then all of a sudden you have the challenge, I think that's worse for baseball than just having a ball that's a little bit outside the strike zone and then slowing the game down and having a challenge. Dude, even look at this Raptors game last night in terms of these reviews and how it just screws up the flow of a game and how nobody wants it. We've got this tight basketball game where there's a ton of energy in the building, and then all of a sudden both coaches make these challenges, and I go, oh, God, it was eight minutes. 8 minutes I timed it out, added to the game for these two things. It's aggressive. It's egregious. It's got
to
go.
No definitive way to tell whether the call was correct or incorrect. Like, that's different than ball strike, though.
Yeah.
But you're talking about, I do agree, like, randomness and, like, weird things happening in sports are great, like things against the norm. A ball hitting a pebble in the infield and skipping away from an infielder is different, though, when some horrible umpire in a crucial moment makes a call incorrectly that he has been calling the correct way throughout the course of the game, right? Like, go back to, again, Game 6, 2015. That was not, like, a call that was a strike throughout the course of the game. That was an outlier, horrible call. The umpire screwed up. Like, there's clutch moments for officials as well. Why wouldn't we give them a safety net?
There's two things. And here's two things where I'm going to close this argument out, then we'll take a break and talk about Jose Bautista. Number one is that I'm just for humans over machines. And as we head into an era where more jobs are going to be taken by robots from humankind, whatever the term is now, I support humans over robots, okay? You are for robots, and you are for automation, and you are for, you know, UBI and people turning into idiocracy and being on their, you know, lazy boy chair with the feeding tube into them and just, you know, nothing.
I prefer WALL-E, but yeah.
Yeah, anyway. So, yeah, I am pro-human over machine. Two is that these guys across from me, they suffered, actually, like, people want to cry about Ben Revere. These guys suffered a missing out on a Super Bowl because an official missed a call. Nicole Roby-Coleman. These two guys across from me are both Saints fans. Guess what happened? Saints missed the Super Bowl. It sucked. Would they have rather have had the review? Yeah, maybe, except for this. The NFL brought the review in next year on those plays, and it was such a disaster that they immediately had to abandon it. It did not work. We try it out, And once again, it doesn't work. Like, all of these things that we claim we want to have, when they actually put them into practice, I'm having trouble thinking about a single thing that I actually like from the standpoint of review. Like, do you have one that you like? Do you think goaltender interference has been good? You think, no, you like all the reviews?
No. So, like, judgment calls are BS. I would say in baseball, it's good that, yeah,
baseball
we can tell when... What's that?
I just said it, that the robots themselves, they don't view the exact strike zone as the strike zone in baseball.
I'm not talking about strike zone, though.
Okay.
Review it. You hate it when, like, a call that clearly looked like was out was called safe, and then upon review,
I like it more than seeing somebody slide into second base, and then when they pop up, the second baseman holds the glove on them, and they come off the base
by like a millimeter. Too, right? Like, I'm surprised that there hasn't been a rule enacted to fix that, because I agree. Like, that's garbage.
But that's what I'm saying. You can't have the picking and choosing.
You can.
All right.
Why not? Well, if I'm, like, in charge of baseball, I can't just,
fairness.
Like, decide.
So, you're deciding that, and then all of a sudden a World Series does come down to the guy popping off the bag for a split second, and we go,
like,
no,
like,
that's...
We played the whole season under Ben Ennis's rules, so obviously, like...
God, what
a nightmare. Nobody's going to complain, because I've said, hey, we're not using review to look at if somebody's foot popped off the bag for a nanosecond. It's for the initial contact with the bag. If you make initial contact, you get like 0.2 of a second to put your foot back on the bag, and if somebody tags you within that span, you're not out. Hey, guess what? I just solved the problem.
Yeah, okay.
Who has an issue with that?
I gotta tell you. The
world is
the
evolving.
Scenario,
you can change.
You did kind of invent what the NFL has right
now. Yeah, of course.
Now.
Yeah.
Like, you deserve credit for that? You do?
100%.
Like, I deserve credit for a golf pervert?
For those of you
that don't know, golf pervert was my idea, like, I don't know, 8 years ago, that they just have you can basically pick any golfer that you want to watch, but you have it like on a screen, you know, like a security guard. You just can pick. And I was like, yeah, because you just like spying your voyeur. I should have called it golf voyeur, but maybe golf pervert was better. Yeah, funny. That's funny. I gotta tell you, the world of Ben Ennis decides the rules, I'm really not into. Okay, we've gone too long on this. I want to take a quick break. I want to come back. I want to talk about Jose Bautista.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right. Good hour continues with old Benny boy, Ben Ennis. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus, at Sportsnet Ben. Can reach out anytime about who you think is right about officials.
It's pretty amazing that you have turned your show into the show of like sports team owners who you think should get all the trophies immediately upon championships, and then now officials. Like, now you're pro official, pro billionaire, anti machine, pro human. Mm-hmm. But yeah, billionaires and officials. That's the official stance of the J.D. Bunkus podcast.
Again, I know that for simpletons like you, you don't understand what nuance is, and so you see everything in black and white because you're too stupid to be able to understand, like, the in-between parts of things. So it's okay. Like, I will try to lower myself to you at times to try, but then when it just goes over your head like it has those last two segments, I have to be the bigger person and accept that. It's just, it's time to move on, and it's time to just give up hope on people like you.
For sure.
No, ownership in sports definitely doesn't matter. So then never complain about it next time your team loses and they make moves.
Sucking
anyway.
Up to billionaires. You want, yeah. You
Why
want
wouldn't I suck
lackey?
Up to billionaires? You think if they actually cared about me enough to have me suck up to them, you think I would be above that? And especially this is rich coming from you. Like, literally the number one suck up who I have not, I wish people could see just like a montage that I would throw up of Ben being like, I love authority. I'll suck up to authority. I'll debase myself or anything. Like, you're the number one guy for that. But anyways, moving on. Jose Bautista. He's going to a level of excellence, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, sure. Of course he is. I have two thoughts on this, and I want you to weigh in on both. One is, where do you place him amongst the greatest Blue Jays that you've ever seen? And I know that you go back further with this team than I do. One, because you're older, but two, because, you've just been a longer baseball fan than I was. I liked the Mariners growing up. I wasn't even like a Blue Jays fan. I was a fake Blue Jays fan as a child celebrating the World Series. But in the 90s and early 2000s, when I got into baseball, I was definitely way more into the Mariners than the Jays. One is that. Where do you place him? And two, Do you think that there has been weirdness with Bautista in this franchise and like maybe that goes away? Because I've been thinking about how it does always feel a little bit to me like this franchise is a bit disconnected from their former greats. And I even felt this with Halliday too. And it not even being the biggest surprise that he wasn't going to go to the Hall of Fame with like a Blue Jays cap, whatever. And I know that things played out strangely there, obviously, and tragically there. But my point is that it does feel like there are a lot of former Blue Jays that don't feel tethered to this organization the way that they should. The crappy thing is the number one guy for that was Roberto Alomar. They had to scrub him from the history books, essentially. But outside of that, there's a lot of players that they don't feel like they're around it. Maybe it's just a byproduct of this being a different country from the place most of them make their homes in. I don't really know, but it's not exactly like you feel the presence of a lot of Jays alumni, especially prominent ones around the team. And I wonder if there's a chance here with Bautista to change that a little bit.
Okay. So you did the thing they told you not to do in journalism school.
No, shut up. This is my show.
Multiple questions.
Yeah, in journalism school, guess what they never did? I should teach literally every single person that teaches at a journalism school. Like I would, what? Someone's going to out-qualify me at these schools? Have you seen those schools? I pluck those kids out of there like Jobo and go, don't worry, I'll actually teach you how to do this for real instead of what you're getting in here.
Now anyway. I'm getting further away from your question. I have a difficult time remembering your question. So let's go back to the first one. Where does Jose Bautista rank?
And is there actually a weirdness and disconnect between the Blue Jays' greatest stars and the organization to you?
Okay.
Or is that me making anecdotal evidence and I'm just kind of over-examining something that isn't real?
All right, let's take the first one. To me, he's two behind Roy Halladay in the favorite Blue Jays I've ever watched. And it's so hard to compare a pitcher to a position player, but Roy Halladay did the thing that all I've ever wanted a pitcher to do, which is like go nine innings to induce contact, to try and get things done as quickly as possible. That's why like Kevin Gausman's season, even more like Alek Manoah was great last year too. And like you put the numbers side by side. To me, Kevin Gausman was just more a pleasure to watch because of the way he filled the strike zone. And the way he wasn't afraid of contact. Now, unfortunately for him, it like ended up being base hits more often than he would have liked. He got absolutely BABIP to death last year and still had a great year. But Roy Halladay did that. Like, that was his MO, right? Mm-hmm. He remade himself with the ability to induce contact and go deep in games and finish as the American League leader in complete games. But behind him, it has to be Jose Bautista. And Carlos Delgado has a good case, but those teams stunk, right? Yeah. Like, it's just so hard to... And Roy Halladay, played on some pretty smelly teams as well. But, he was just so far and away above everybody else I think he rose past
the stinkiness. Roy Halladay made you be, like, proud to be a Jays fan in an era with a lot of bad teams.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with your rankings. It's just the weird one with me with Bautista is I think Edwin was always a little bit more loved. He just wasn't as great, and he certainly wasn't as great for longer. And, there was something about the prickishness to Bautista that I think even rubbed some Blue Jays fans the wrong way in terms of just,
honestly,
like, fully embracing him.
Really? Because I go the opposite way on it. I think, and I've talked about this a little bit yesterday, that he had a scowl, but, like, in the best way, right? That he was a total pro, and he would get mad at umpires, he would get mad at opposition players, he would even get mad at his manager on occasion, and probably his teammates as well, but all in the name of being the best and winning. And he also, like, so I just like guys that do things aesthetically the way that I like it. Like I said, Roy Halladay inducing contact. Jose Bautista just understanding the value of taking a pitch that may or may not be a strike, but like is not a pitch that you can hit for a home run, and working a count and taking walks and having an absurd on base and then mashing 54 home runs. And before he tore his arm to shreds, the incredible arm from right field. No, he was, and that he was a total revelation, that they got him for nothing off the scrap heap from the Pirates, and Cito Gaston somehow, I guess, like turned him into a power hitter by telling him to try and hit home runs. And that's all he had to do was tell him to hit home runs. Then he hit 54. But now to the second part of that.
Wait,
as far as the disc.
Can I stop you in on that part? Can I just weigh in there for a second?
Yeah.
Because I agree with you. And upon reflecting on his Jays career, I thought two things are a little bit understated with him. One is the 54 home run season is just kind of like a number we flash up on a screen, but it for, I think it's because Donaldson came after, like Donaldson being,
and won an MVP.
Yeah, Donaldson winning the MVP weirdly takes away something from Bautista's career. Like when we think about the 2015 Jays, we think about Donaldson first, and we can all accept that it's a little bit of the Kawhi thing happening there. Except for with Kawhi, it's like Lowry was around longer. They had gone through more struggles. They had been more playoff battles. I just think people liked Kyle Lowry more in this city, identified with Kyle Lowry more than they did with Jose Bautista in a way, if that makes any sense. Like the Jays were irrelevant for a couple of his years. And yes, he was a scrap heap guy. But even the 54 home run season, why I think it gets screwed over a little bit is there was so much smoke around Bautista being a cheater. And he obviously wasn't, but you don't remember that? Oh, my God.
I mean, people, I remember, like, he obviously is juicing because one reporter said you had to ask the question, but that was it. Yeah. That was like,
oh, okay. I remember it being more tied to this. Like, people had, I guess maybe it wasn't that he was getting called out for being a cheater constantly. It was that people just had a raised eyebrow about it. Like, how could this be? Like, how could this guy go from being the scrap heap pitcher from the Pirates organization to a 54 home run guy?
Yeah, I mean, that does happen, though, right? Like, it happened multiple times in the Blue. It happened, like, happened with Edwin Encarnacion as well.
Thank you for that insight. You're like, that does happen. It's like, yeah, we're literally discussing a time where it did. But anyways, go on. You can move to the second point. I just wanted to make the point about Donaldson.
Yeah, no, and no doubt, like, the highs were higher for Donaldson, although, I mean, man, go back to even the year after the 54 home runs. Yeah, he had an OPS over 1,000, right? Played
brilliant.
149 games.
Yeah.
He was and a great defender in right field. Now, as far as the disconnect, I think for him, he signed this deal. Alex Anthopoulos was under the gun to sign him to understand what he was, because he had this incredible season. And it's like, well, okay, so is he that? Like, do we pay him for that? Or do we pay him for what he was before that, which was, like, not much of anything? Did he just have this incredible season? And Alex Anthopoulos took a risk in signing him to a contract extension that Jose Bautista totally overperformed, right? Like, he way, way overperformed. But at the time, it was a massive, massive risk. And I remember it being a huge point of discussion. And then after that, like, Jose Bautista felt, remember, he wrote down the number on the piece of paper in spring training.
And he felt
that
like he had been screwed over. And Arden Zwelling was like, pay him whatever he wants in front of us.
Right. And then he went out and then, you know, started to not be so great anymore. Yeah. And the Blue Jays kind of did him a favor with that, the bizarro 2-year deal with the, like, mutual option, which is never, I don't know, like, in the history of mutual options, is anyone ever, like, both turned their key where they performed to the exact number and everybody agrees one more year of that? So obviously that was never going to happen. And then, it was kind of – he thought he could continue to be an effective major leaguer elsewhere, and that never proved to be the case. I think that's part of the discussion.
I can't
it's also
remember
part of the discussion.
The places that he ended up. Like, I know Oakland was the one of them.
No, Oakland was not one of them.
I thought he went to Oakland at the very end and tried to make the team, and he didn't break the team out of camp. No?
I don't know.
Bautista went to the Phillies at the very end.
He went to the Phillies. Okay, he went to the Mets. And
I knew Mets.
Yeah. And Braves.
Oh, yeah. Braves. Yeah,
Edwin Encarnacion was a member of the Oakland A's for like a winter, for like a couple of days in the winter.
Okay, maybe I'm confusing those two things. Anyways, you're right. That does add to the weirdness. Is like the exit was super uncomfortable, and it was kind of sad.
Yeah, because it wasn't like Edwin, right? Like, Edwin got his goodbye. He got to do his on-field thing. Everybody knew that he was gone.
Is everybody still doing the, hey, the Edwin for Kendrys wasn't that bad because they got Nate Pearson? Wow, that turned out to be great. Yeah.
No.
Anyway, just let's not forget those of you who had that take. Not me. I was not one. I own all my bad takes. Not that one. I was always pro bring Edwin back. Anyway, sorry, Benny.
Yeah. So Edwin is, well, he's back with the organization now. I don't know what his title is, but he's like he's like a guest instructor at Jay's camp, and he's going to be part of the organization forever and ever and ever. Vernon Wells is the other guy that we've talked about, how it's weird that he's kind of had a weird relationship with the organization. It's not like he's a level of excellence guy, but
he's close.
Man, he re-signed with the team, right? Everybody thought he would be gone, a homegrown guy who... Mm-hmm. Yeah, played for, again, some crappy teams and wasn't the perfect player, but, you know, played a bunch and played some pretty good defense in center field and hit a bunch of home runs. And I think there was awkwardness there as well, especially, I mean, that comes from the fan base, though, right?
Yeah.
Because by the time that they finally found a taker for his contract everybody was ready to see him disappear. And sure. then outside of them, there was a lot of guys like
but he's
Tony
also
Fernandez,
mentioned
when he was
on
alive,
the record
he was always
to
around.
Us, Vernon what? Wells, he has also mentioned on record to us that it's been weirdness from the organization as well. Not happy with the fans situation, so he doesn't come back, right? Like that's mm-hmm. very much a organization to the player. There has been a real disconnect. So yeah, no, I'm not putting that one on the fans. What were you saying though? You can finish the last joke.
No, I was gonna say that the guys from the championship era, right, are always around.
Yeah.
Listen, you can't swing a dead cat in and around the anniversaries of 92 and 93 without seeing Joe Carter, right? Yeah. He has a golf tournament every single yep. year. He's also on the level of excellence. And when Tony Fernandez was alive, he was always around. No, Pat Borders.
But that's
was
what makes
on
it even weirder to me.
The other day.
That's what makes it even weirder to me is that okay. Obviously, you win a championship in a city and you're a different level of beloved and everybody remembers you down to the like Jody Meekses of the team, right? Like 20 years from now, Jody Meeks is going to come to the city and people are going to be like, man, you were great. He's going to go, yeah, thank you. You know, like it's going to be a lot of that. Jeremy Lin is going to show up. People are going to be wanting their piece of the pie that were part of the 2019 Toronto Raptors, and especially a place that hasn't won a ton. So you just remember the team more distinctly than in places where you rack up multiple championships, like a New England Patriots fan, where you're like, who was on that team? Who was on the 0-1 winner, you know, versus the 0-4? But yeah, just that, like, that is the part that sort of disproves a little bit my theory of, well, maybe it's just a different country thing. And maybe this is just a time will tell situation, but it doesn't feel like, yeah. There has been anybody from that 2015 team outside of maybe, yeah, now Edwin sort of turning around and being a part of the team spring training wise, or from mm-hmm. anybody from basically like 2000 onward, where I go, oh yeah, that guy was a really good Blue Jays player who is affiliated with the team in a very direct and impactful way. It's been a very long time since they've had dudes like that around the organization. Like, again, close your
really
eyes.
Bad and, for like two decades.
Sure,
you know?
But even bad teams have alumni. Buddy, you think the Leafs?
Sure.
Like, look at the Leafs. Like, some of the guys that, sure. you know, I don't want to take too much. But, yeah, some of the players, people go, wow, look at, he's here in the building. Like, that's not
no,
what it's
but,
about. They don't go and say, who did you
they
win?
They had a modicum of success, right? Like, you know, there were some early 90s Leaf teams.
Dude, 06 Jays were
runs.
Really fun. Like, there were some good
sure.
Jays teams in there. No.
So what you would like to see, like, Troy Gloss and Benji Molina.
That would actually be amazing.
Hanging
you,
out.
You don't think that would be cool to be at a Blue Jays game and see BJ Ryan?
Sure.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, BJ Ryan, I think, has like just disappeared. He had the Tommy John, and then he was out of baseball, and then like you can't hear from him.
Yeah.
I do think that there's guys. I think as we get further away from 15, 16, and certainly when Josh Donaldson retires, he's like every time he plays in Toronto, he loves to talk about those glory years
sure.
and winning the MVP in 2015.
Well, he's a man without country without the Blue Jays, because he's not going to be a Yankee.
Yankees fans hate his guts,
no,
right?
I know. Yeah. He's not a twin, he's not a Yankee, and I don't think he's an athletic. Okay, I got one more for you before we go. One quick thing. We got to be fast here. I'll do this a little bit more, and I'm going to talk about this. I think I'm hopefully going to have a chat with Dan Shulman about this, but I've mentioned it to you in passing a little bit about us not caring about World Baseball Classic and why it's not a bigger deal. Especially since Major League Baseball actually embraces it. Like, this isn't a product that they don't want their guys necessarily going to. They want this to grow. It's supposed to be fun. We don't seem to put any pressure on the Canadian players for going. Why doesn't Joey Votto go? Like, if Freddie Freeman's going, don't we care Joey Votto goes? And are you, Joey Votto's biggest fan, willing to accept now at this point of his career? It's gotten to a point where it's just, it's 100% cringe. There's no, like, cool. It's just all bad and, like, If you see Joey Votto and it comes up on my, you know, reels, that's an auto skip for me. It's like, why isn't he at World Baseball Classic? Why don't we care about that, given where he's at in his career and, like, his taking shots at Canada? And then, yeah, cringe, the king of the cringe. Is Joey Votto now the most cringy guy, him and LeBron, in sports?
I can follow you down the cringe wormhole, but as far as why he's not playing in this World Baseball Classic, and by the way, he has played in previous editions of the World Baseball Classic.
Didn't he play in only
one? He like just had shoulder surgery. He missed the end of last season. I don't even know if he's going to be ready for opening day for the Reds this season, which, people, if you do follow him
do
on
your
Instagram,
rehab. Would, get ready.
Yeah.
Do your rehab on the fly at the World Baseball Classic, Joe.
Okay. But yeah, I don't know. He's too self-aware, right? It was kind of funny
much.
When people talking about him being Joey Mopo because he loves to mop and like being a bit of a weird guy. But now that he's embraced it too much and said, this is my brand. Hey, look at me. I play chess and I'm not very good at chess.
I take the subway. Ooh, okay.
He takes the subway, lives in Toronto. Yeah. I don't know. Cringe might be a little extreme, but he's just too self-aware, right? Like you can see the seams too much. You can see how it's stitched together. It doesn't feel organic anymore.
I'm going to make a Mount Rushmore of current athletes that are the most cringe, and LeBron and Joey are like they're the bona fides. There's nobody else.
Like hearing about LeBron's dreams?
No, I don't. And even now, like yesterday, it's a daily thing with him now where he's not allowed to not have the attention any day. It's just the league is looking good and LeBron's like, my son's better than a lot of these guys. And you're like, okay, all right, LeBron. What's going on there? Are you all right?
I mean, you've been known for your incredible GM acumen. So
exactly. No, LeBron, the builder. Anyways, that's probably how he'll go into the Hall of Fame. Anyway, Ben Ennis, thanks for coming on. Always fun, buddy. Go watch F1 so we can talk about it next week. Thank you, you fraud. Goodbye, Ben Ennis.
Rude.
Fan drive time later today where you won't hear about F1 because this guy completely abandoned it the second it wasn't like the most popular thing for him. It's bad. It's casual, unlike me. Quick break, and then, Ryan O'Reilly. Oof. And then we'll talk to Shayna Goldman of The Athletic. So, bad news for Leaf fans yesterday, but predictable news. As I was saying with Luke Fox, there was no way that they were splinting that finger and that their head coach was going to be that mad and that he wouldn't be returning to the game if that finger was just going to be all right. Ryan O'Reilly, Leafs are saying that they expect him to be back for the regular season. Again, I know I talked about how if the doctors don't have the charts, can they really know? But I consulted a couple of doctors about it. Mm. And finger, and I'll just tell you what they told me.
I thought you were Dr. Bunkus from yesterday.
I was. And that's why I properly diagnosed it as this is going to be a broken finger. And
then you consulted your colleagues.
That's right.
In the medical field.
Right,
exactly.
Every doctor I asked said between 4 to 6 weeks. Obviously depends on where the fracture is. And whether or not it was displaced or whether it requires splinting. Like, these are all factors in it. Mm. Obviously, him being a pro athlete, like the cardiovascular system, they usually rate of recovery is faster. But both basically said to me, both doctors I asked said, minimum of 4 weeks. Like, there's just, like, pushing past 4 weeks is not really going to be a reality. And let's just even for grace give him the fourth, right? Mm. Okay, so Ryan O'Reilly gets hurt. On March 4th, he can return at the very best, let's say, April 4th against the Blue Jackets.
Mm. In Luke Fox's article, he said the earliest he's eligible to return is March 29. But obviously, that's just happen.
That's 6 games left for a month, for 4 weeks. My guess is that the Maple Leafs will be abundant, like they will exercise an abundance of caution with this injury.
Mm-hmm.
That April 4th is basically the first day that to me, you can expect Ryan O'Reilly back. Anything earlier than that, the problem with the finger, as all like these doctors kept telling me, is that if you rush it back, the rate of re-injury is actually pretty high. Mm. That you can really risk hurting it again. And so for me, heading into the postseason with the number one guy that you required to help with your Stanley Cup pursuit, I don't think you're bringing him back early for chemistry purposes. And this is something that I want to talk about with Shayna Goldman in a couple minutes here, which is just simply, you know, how much we really need to find out chemistry for the most part. Because I do think that it's something where it's different for different players, right? Mm-hmm. Some guys just, they don't mesh well together, whatever, for whatever reason. There's definitely unquantifiables to chemistry.
Yeah.
Right. But my general belief is that good players, they mesh with good players, and that it's easier. We look at that and say, wow, look at the chemistry between them. It's like, I think in hockey, they're just mostly elite. Mm. But some players do mix well better with others. And there is something to that. And what I think stinks about this is that you're really not going to be able to find out too much about who the best mix of bottom six guys are with Ryan O'Reilly.
Mm.
It's the biggest issue with all of this. Number two is, I think that you're going to put a little bit more stress on your top guys. Yeah, you were able to have Tavares get bumped out to the wing. Tavares hurt too, by the way. Seems less serious. This sounds like actually, I know he's actually hurt, but that sounds like a you excuse, Jobo, where you're like, I can't come into work today because I'm not quite feeling myself. That's a
after
Jobo.
Got rocked against
Vancouver. But that's exactly the type of excuse that you would use to try to get out of work.
I don't do that.
Yes, you
it's
would.
Not that
yes,
bad.
Yeah, you're right. You do worse. Joe straight up didn't show up for work one day and was like, oh, I told Pete.
Yeah, I know. That was a bad one.
I was like, do you know how work functions?
That was like my first couple of weeks, too.
Yeah, that was a tough start. Young Joe was on the hot seat for that one. Anyway, so that's the thing to me. Can you find out whether or not there are players that are the right mix with Ryan O'Reilly, given the limited amount of games that you're going to have? I know that he can play with good players. I know that if you drop him into a lineup and he's in between John Tavares and Mitch Marner or William Nylander, like, that's going to work. Good players playing with good players generally tends to be fine. Mm-hmm. Some guys obviously better than others. What is the unquantifiable? I think it's probably harder with lesser players, mm-hmm, or players who are not as talented, not as offensively gifted as some of the guys that Ryan O'Reilly's likely going to play with upon his return and into the postseason. But yeah, how do you quantify some of this, and like, what's the sample that you actually need? Let's ask somebody who's a lot smarter than me. Shana Goldman, hockey writer for The Athletic and host of the Too Many Men podcast. Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So this is where I want to start today. Is you tweeted recently about how you're curious how guys click with their new clubs. I think we all are, right? Like, that's one of the fun parts of post-deadline. But what do you think the sample is for you that you need to see with pairings or line combinations before you feel like you have a reliable data set?
So that's a good question. It's something I am working on. Specifically with Ryan O'Reilly, actually, that pushed like three times because the week before the deadline was so wild and, mm-hmm, you know, things kept coming up. So it's something that I'm still working on specifically about Ryan O'Reilly and how he's going to click when he returns, because how do you know? And the thing is, like, when you have small samples, it's not that you can't learn anything from them. It's that you have to take it with a grain of salt, you know, and that's why it's always like you'll see small sample warning. You know, we saw five games of this line and, you know, it tells you to see more of it. But that more of it could be bad. It could be just a hot start. You know, it's really tough to tell. So sometimes it helps to kind of study like the players stylistically in their profiles and try to figure out what skill sets would work in a line combination and hope that, yes, you might have had that good start. And yes, you have a small sample and you can roll with that. The beginning of the regular season makes everything really difficult. You know, the time right after the trade deadline does, and then the playoffs are another can of worms because they're all small samples. So it's just finding what to take out of it and not just finding things that fit what you wanted to think. You know, oh, I thought that Ryan O'Reilly would be good with John Tavares because Ryan O'Reilly's been a good playmaker this year and John Tavares is really good at finishing his chances at a higher rate this year. I think they're going to click together. And then you see it and you go, see, I was right. Like, it's just avoiding those pitfalls, I think, is the biggest part of it. But it's taking notes of other things, like, oh, wow, this is a strength of Ryan O'Reilly's game that we've known forever, but now it looks like he has teammates that are going to help him succeed. That's a good note moving forward. Let's see if he keeps it up. And I think that's how you have to view everything.
I got to tell you, though, you just told me to basically do the thing that helped me build my whole career, which is going, hey, I noticed this thing and it confirms my bias. And now I'm going to be really loud about it. And people went, that guy's really loud about that. And so you're telling me to basically avoid being the only way I know how to be successful, which is tough. This is a tough look for me. You basically just showed the blueprint.
Don't totally avoid it. Don't totally avoid it. You can take that too, but just keep your context very open.
Yeah, I'm trying to do that. And with him specifically, like you mentioned the thing about, hey, confirming what you already feel. And I think I've already done that to a degree with good players. Like, I've always been of the mind that, yes, chemistry is a very real thing. It's a fun, unquantifiable thing generally. Like, trying to figure out why guys mesh, we can always do the stylistic thing. There's always, for somebody like me that grew up in the video game era, I think we all tried to do the thing where it was like line matching, where you would go, you wanted to have like the grinder with the playmaker and the score, and you'd get like bonuses for that. And you would go, okay, see, like, this is the way it's supposed to work. Like, this is the way that every line is supposed to be put together. But then we actually watch sports our whole lives and we go, oh, actually, like, that's not really the case. Like, it turns out that everyone just having that one set defined role is not the way to build a perfect hockey team. But when we're talking about like somebody like Ryan O'Reilly and you're getting ready to do a piece like this or an investigation like this, Yeah, like, what do you, when you start to elevate players that are a little bit lower, even if it is in a small sample, how much more do you value something like that versus good players being on a very good line?
Yeah, it's really tough because, especially, like, now we're going to be, like, we look at the Maple Leafs, like, they have so many different players in the mix. And already we've gotten very different results. You compare the Vancouver game to the Calgary game, and you have night and day different results that you're like, what can I take from this? You know, it's something that's going to challenge you. But, you know, it, like, generally speaking, we assume that a player on a bad team is going to move to a good team and be good. They're in a better system. It's more sustainable and things like that. And, like, it doesn't always work, like, totally perfectly. So, you know, that's one part of it that you have to consider and hope generally it's going to work. With this situation, I think it helps in a way because Toronto now has to learn like every other option that they have. And they have to figure out, you know, a player now is going to jump up higher than they should have for this game because you have no Tavares and you have no Ryan O'Reilly, which should never be the case, but it is. And it's like a good chance for them to get like small glimpses at different combinations just to see like, oh, does this click for a second? Because, you know, like you said, you can pull the line stylistically that you think should be the way it is, but it doesn't always work that well. It might so happen that if you put Austin Matthews with the perfect playmaker, you're going to assume Martin's going to set him up, Matthews going to shoot, that's it. But if you take away the playmaker, maybe it makes him look at the game a little bit differently. Maybe he becomes more of a dual threat because he has to be challenged. So you never know how a player is going to react and respond. So you just kind of have to, like, put them in game situations and get ideas from it. And that's why sometimes mixing and matching is such a good thing because there are some coaches who will keep their lines exactly the same and never get a chance to just figure out what else could mesh. And then there's some that they see it meshes, they change it immediately because now they want their next option, but you didn't give them enough time to actually cook to see if it's going to work and know it's a reliable option. So there's all different challenges that you can face along the way. And the Maple Leafs are presented with how best to approach this one. But it just seems like they need to find something that works, roll with it, but not be glued to that option. Even if it works and they start seeing it over an extended sample, like they have the luxury of being kind of locked in a playoff spot. So they can start experimenting and just figure out all the options that they have. So when Ryan O'Reilly returns, they kind of can see exactly what's going to be best for him. And I think the way they handled it post-deadline is interesting because they put him in a position to succeed off the bat. They put him in the best position he could have been in that lineup. So here's a new team. Here's your new system. Go play with two of our best players that we know are perfect together, that you should mesh well with. See how it goes. And that's how you can learn about this team on the fly. And then after that, it was, now let's see how you handle 3C. You have a feel for our team. So it seems like they have a good handle on how to manage these situations, but, you know, you never know how anything's going to unfold. Like, we're talking about a game where everyone's running around with, like, knives on their boots on a slippery surface. It's not the easiest.
Yeah, completely agree. And I do wonder if this is actually going to be more impactful for the Toronto Maple Leafs, where they, the guys that they brought in, it's a lot of bottom six dudes, and I kind of thought that having a Ryan O'Reilly in the bottom six, one of the most important pieces was going to be to find out, like, hey, who are the best guys to fit with him? That moving pieces around like Bunting and Kerfoot and having those two guys get juggled, basically playing on the top line. And I don't want to say an easier job, but yeah, something where you go, this is probably going to end up back the way that it normally started with Bunting up here. Yeah, this just feels like sneaky big to me that they're going to have to continue to shuffle a bunch of guys that we don't really know exactly what they are given these circumstances. And yeah, I think they're only going to get Ryan O'Reilly for maybe like five games, which is why I asked you about the sample question to start. Is I get so many weird answers when it comes to people about what a sample is. Like, clearly 82 games, like, that's a good sample. That's a good sample. We get 82 of them, that's fine. You have people that do things like the old Babcock rule, where it's like five game segments to try to judge something. Then I get people who tell me that Pierre Engvall not scoring for 17 playoff games is not enough of a sample. And I don't know what they are. And so, yeah, trying to get this all up to speed very quickly is going to be really tough for me. Let's go to the Devils here for a second, though. Because one thing, you know, Devils, you write about them, you watch them more than a lot of us. You gave them a 9 out of 10 for their deadline. And this is probably a little bit too far ahead to predict. And, like, I do want to get into the other stuff with them, like, in their chemistry. But do you think that this is a team that's going to end up keeping Timo Meier?
Yeah. They can swing it. They can afford it. They can make it work. They can make it work with his contract and Brad's contract. Will they? we never know. If they hold firm that a player can't make more than Jack Hughes, and I'm not saying that that is what they're going to do, but every team, not every team, but some teams do have that, like, internal cap. You look at, you know, the Buffalo Sabres, like, most forwards don't make more than Tate Thompson, except for Jeff Skinner, that was a previous manager. You look at how the Devils did it. The centers make, you know, similar money, and sometimes the center is more valuable than the winger, and the winger's not going to outspend them. You look at the Bruins, generally speaking, no one made money like David Pastrnak does. So you don't know how it's actually going to unfold. If they hold firm that a forward can't make more than $8 million, it's probably not going to work out because Timo Meier is going to make more than $8 million. He should. He's worth it. He should be in the $9 million range at minimum. He could be in the $10 million range too. So I do think they knew that going in. You know, so it's not like, hey, this is a one-and-done rental, unless they planned on trading him to recoup some of their assets, which would be a good bit of business, but then would put them in the same position where they started this year. I think he sticks around in New Jersey, though. I think the fit should be good there. I think they can make the money work, and I think it really solidifies their window of contention that is starting maybe a little earlier than some expected. They're capitalizing off a strong season, but they want that momentum moving forward too. You don't want it to just die after this year because you don't have that next winger in the fold.
So when it comes to chemistry, it's pretty easy. Like, he scores in his first game and they did the thing that I said works, which is, again, a really brilliant thing that I've come up with, is if you put good players with good players, it's going to work out for you. Like, I know, it's just don't steal that from me, please. Jack Hughes, Jesper Bratt, Timo Meier line. They're just deep, the Devils. And okay, like you said, you gave them 9 out of 10 for their deadline. They got the best player at the deadline. And yet I kind of felt like they got swept under the rug a little bit. And I can only speak from a Canadian standpoint, like a bit of a, you know, national standpoint. They made the Timo Meier trade, like, while the Leafs were doing a bunch of things. And up here, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of people talk about them, the Toronto Maple Leafs. And so Luke Shen.
How does it affect the Leafs? We all know it. We all live by it.
Yeah, exactly. So Luke Shen going to the Leafs for a third ends up being a much bigger talking point than Timo Meier going to the Devils. But yeah, you're just getting ready for the game and you're doing your research and you're kind of reading some stuff and you're looking at their lines and you're looking at, yeah, the recent success and, you know, a little breakout stretch from Dawson Mercer. And you're starting to say, yeah, Rangers got a ton of attention because they got Patty Kane and everybody knows who he is. He's just more of a household brand. Obviously, the Bruins get a ton of attention because of who they are and what they're doing. I think Tampa ended up getting some negative attention and then it sort of bucked back the other way. And it just kind of felt like Timo Meier went a little bit under the radar. And that's sort of been the MO from a national standpoint, or at least a Canadian standpoint this season, is it's been, hey, the Devils are fun, the Devils are cute. And then a lot of people going, the Devils probably aren't going to do anything. And now I kind of feel like we've gone too far with that take. Like, how do you feel about them just in terms of the being slept on angle here?
I mean, I think that's like the story of the Devils' lives. It does feel that way because they always have like the little brother syndrome. And there are a lot of teams like that. But like, the Devils have always played second fiddle to the Rangers. It's just the way it is. It's just, you know, the market. What hurt them with the Meier thing, I think, is one, it happened on a Sunday night. Two, it took a million hours for that trade to actually unfold. And the return was underwhelming for San Jose, I would say. And I think that is like a little bit, it leaves you without enough intrigue. And then here it is, Meier returns to the lineup. Everyone, I'm sure, would have hoped it would have been against Colorado. It could have been against Vegas. This is the big games, big pop. It's against the Arizona Coyotes in Arizona. So you're right. And other teams are making moves that, the Patrick Kane deal, everybody saw coming, was waiting for it to happen. The Boston Bruins were surprising everybody because they weren't done yet, and they're trying to be like this mega team. Like, it makes sense that they got swept under the rug a bit. I think that was the case with them earlier this season, too. I mean, if you look at the beginning of the year, the way the Devils were playing, after their beginning stretch of, like, terrible goaltending, ruining everything, and when they got their footing, you know, like, three games in, they were coming in with this, like, really, really, really high-speed game, and so many teams were on their heels going, we didn't expect this from the Devils and things like that. Like, we didn't know how to react to that. And that's why the Devils were winning. You did see it start to change because teams start reacting to them, adjusting to them, studying them, figuring it out. And then it was on the Devils to, you know, react once more. And they took a little longer than they should have. But I think this could be the same thing. Like, everyone sleeps on it. Then they'll play them and go, oh, wait a second. There's Jack Hughes and Timo Meier on the same line. Now we have to react to that too. And then, you know, the story can build from there. Maybe it's a little bit less exciting though, because there's other, you know, Rangers Devils series is exciting, especially in the market, but there's so many other storylines too to keep, you know, pay attention to, like what's going on in the West. Are the Flames not going to make the playoffs? You know, can Toronto finally figure out a way to get past Tampa? Who is Boston going to dismantle? Who's even going to be in the wild card race? Like, there's so many other storylines. So I think that's playing into it as well. But, you know, it's a good team. And I think the more they play bigger teams like the Maple Leafs and stand up to contenders, because it wasn't super exciting to see them go up against Coyotes and then almost fall back. And, you know, it hurts, I think, the whole overall vibe and chances of them getting the attention.
I gotta tell you, I really want Devils Rangers. There's something about it that is, there's certain jersey matchups that are just that they fit your eye and you go, this is right. This is the
red
way.
Red versus blue. It's just perfect.
Yeah, it just Devils Rangers is just right to me. Where I'm like, I can put that on TV and it's like calming. I'm like, this is nice. This feels good. So yeah, to get that for a playoff series, I really can't wait. Hey, Shayna, I'm a big fan of podcasts. Really enjoy your work at The Athletic. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. There's Shayna Goldman, host of the Too Many Men podcast and hockey writer for The Athletic. Okay, a couple things quickly. One is... Leafs struggled with the Devils this year. People forget.
Mm-hmm.
I don't forget.
You don't forget nothing.
Lock that sucker in the vault. I remember, because here's the thing. Leafs have kicked the living crap out of a lot of teams this year, even when they've lost.
Mm-hmm.
Even games where they've lost, you've gone, eh, whatever.
There's still something there.
Yeah. I actually think, like, in some ways, it's pretty wild that we expect the Leafs to win every single night, and people are pissed when they lose and they lay an egg. And I get it, because you're afraid of the playoffs and there's a ton of pressure on this team. I'm not criticizing anybody for the way they react to Maple Leafs losses, okay? That's
huge your swings every time, right?
Yeah, well, kind of. And yeah, people want to mock the fan base. I just think this is anywhere where people give a crap about teams. Like, you're going to get a wide variance of opinion and feeling and emotion. And for a team like this, where so many people care and they've struggled for so long and they've been a punchline for so long, punching bag, same
punching
thing.
Bag works as well.
Both, yeah. Nice. I was like a little tripped up. It's same fine. Thing. My only point is that you watch them every night, and how often do you really feel like their opponent was just better than them? Like, have you ever watched a Leaf game and gone, damn, those guys are just way better? Mm-hmm. I think that their most recent loss to the Bruins.
That's what I was about to say. The last time they played the Bruins was a game that you look at it and you're like, oh, that team's really good.
That was a humbling one where you said, damn, they're really skilled, but also they just play with a nastiness that Toronto couldn't match. Mm-hmm. I think Toronto's gotten better in that regard. Boston has gotten better too with their skill. They're just so deep. They're definitely the favorite in the NHL at this point.
Yeah.
But outside of that, like, go through the schedule. Last time Leafs played the Devils, I'm pretty sure they beat them. And then the time before that was the overtime game where I thought New Jersey was just better, faster, sharper than Toronto. There was a game this season against the Golden Knights where Vegas, I think actually both games, because they played them twice now, where Vegas looked better both times. And I went, damn, this team just matches up against Toronto well. They caught them at the right time in the schedule. Yeah. They just look better. Outside of that, like...
The Leafs last played the Devils all the way back in November, too.
Yeah.
So months ago.
Yeah. The Oilers looked a lot better than the Leafs, but I think, again, that was a... There's a difference I think we should be able to understand of the Leafs just looking horrific and the other team playing well versus, hey, Leafs looked okay tonight. The other team was just better than them. Mm-hmm. It's happened a handful of times. It's a really, really good hockey team. I kind of think the Devils might be on that, like, in that tier. And I always love a bounce back game because normally, you know, you come back to the East Coast after a West Coast road trip. They're not home. Their first home game is Saturday night against the Oilers. That will also be. But this week, these next bunch of games, they're pretty interesting for the Leafs. They lose Ryan O'Reilly. They're still going to be searching for what the combinations are down the lineup.
Yep.
Michael Bunting is in the complete doghouse.
Yep.
Where Sheldon Keefe's saying he has a mental block, saying that Alex Kerfoot's playing better than him recently. Also, people are freaking out about that. Alex Kerfoot has been playing better than him recently.
He's been playing very well.
He's been playing good.
Yeah.
Let's at least criticize fairly with certain players. Is Alex Kerfoot the perfect player? Is he ever going to be an elite finisher? Is he ever going to be worth the $3.5 million to Toronto Maple Leafs? No. But has he been awesome since right around the deadline and extending past? Yeah, dude, he's had real jump to his game. He's looked solid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Devils, Oilers, Sabres, Avs, Hurricanes, and then hungry Sens trying to make the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Fun stretch and all packed within essentially a week and a half.
Yeah, I got like the Hurricanes the week after too.
Yeah, this week's light, but then the following week, it is a gauntlet. They play four games in 6 days.
Yeah.
Against good teams. Yeah. So I'm very excited to see how this team is able to maintain their level throughout this. I've said it before. I think the regular season still is important for this team. I think that we overreact to some of the lulls they have, that you're not going to have 82 games where you look brilliant. It's just not going to happen.
Yep.
The Bruins, what, they're 49 wins and 62 or something like that. That's a crazy, crazy outlier. For the Leafs, they've been a damn good hockey team this year for the most part, but it was a very different hockey team.
Mm-hmm.
They've really changed the team a lot. So what does this new team look like, again, without being able to experiment with the main addition to the forward group,
yeah,
which most people, including myself, thought was the most important part of the trade deadline?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, take a quick break. Let's come back. Let's hit all the things we missed.
OG.
Sportsnet 590.
I like getting the messages about ref talk. Ref talk always fires people up. Anyway, any final thoughts?
I have no final thoughts, except I still hate the Rams.
Okay, Jobo.
My only final
thought. Again, the whole reason we talked about, the whole reason Scotty Barnes got ejected is because Jobo thinks that scripting is real and we have to fight against that.
I do. The script.
So Scotty Barnes, Raptors lose because Jobo in no way.
I actually ejected Scotty. Sorry, guys.
In a way, you did.
I just hate all reviews in sports.
Yeah, me too.
I hate them all. Like, if you're not going to get the calls 100% of the time anyway,
that's the only
point of reviews, and you still botch them, so get them out of here. It slows down the game. It kills momentum. And like you said, I like being mad at refs.
Yeah.
It's what bond is like, you know, sometimes
keep
it's just bond
mad.
Sports
it's so
fans.
Good. It's being mad at refs is you the know? Best.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is definitely a be careful what you wish for situation all the time. I can't believe that people have experienced everything from VAR to baseball reviews to pass interference reviews or what is and isn't a catch in football to slowing down the ends of basketball games.
Basketball is brutal.
Yeah.
They've got to figure that out.
For these coaches' challenges and like the injustice that is when the ball grazes off of a guy's fingertip when it's the other person that directs a ball out of bounds, and every game in the history of basketball has
like his hair
been,
molecules
yeah,
like
exactly.
brush it, and it's like, oh, it touched him.
Like, what are we basing review off of that makes us want more? I don't understand what we've seen so far that is compelling people to say, yes, please, more review.
Yeah.
And that's why I brought up the umpire thing. What's it called? The AVN machine?
not that.
No.
So it's from Hawkeye. It's called ABS.
Yeah, that's it.
The automatic balls and strikes.
The automatic balls and strike system.
Yes.
The robot that they made.
Mm-hmm.
They got it down to a science. It was pinpointing exactly what the strike zone was supposed to be. The players, the managers, the leagues, they all agreed it was crap. And they had to expand it off the plate. But again, now you've asked the machines to make it, and now it felt better, right? They agreed, hey, this feels better now that we've decided to expand the zone a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, except there's a couple things to this. One, do you really want every single blowout baseball game where the thing is calling it perfectly and balls and strikes, and you get in a crappy pitcher who can't really find the strike zone, and now it's going longer?
It's like 13-1, and the guy's just throwing balls out there.
Or do you just want the umpire back there who is going, yep, I know what to do here. I'm a pro. I'm going to move this game along. Again, 14 calls a game sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
It's really not.
No, it's not.
Most umpires, pretty damn good. And I know I rip them and I hate on them sometimes, and I will change this opinion at some point in time. People can reference this when I get really pissed at an egregious job by an official. I like this stuff. I think it's better to have the humans out there. I'm tired of us just perpetually wanting more and more review whenever we get it. It just ends up being worse.
I also hate, here's another like bad consequence of review, is now every player in like basketball and football like immediately turn to their coach to challenge it or something, and it's just some of these are not even close. Like guys are saying like, hey, throw the challenge flag, I caught that, and you look at the replay and it's like not even
Nick Nurse's
close.
Way is the most like, I can't even say the words because I can't think of like any way of saying this without swearing.
You can't do it on the air.
But when Nick Nurse does it, first of all, he puts his like only one index finger on his palm for his timeout. He doesn't do the full tee. He does one like little tap and then he spins his finger around and he talks during it. Like he talks. And yesterday his was emotional. Again, I thought it was part of the meltdown where was that a tough call to take in that spot? 100%
Yeah.
But that's where you need your coach to be a good coach.
Yeah.
Is to, you got to keep a composure. That's that spot. And he's going, he hooked him. He hooked him. And then I watched the replay and I go, no, that's not getting overturned at all. You were just emotional.
No shot at that.
Yeah. There was 0% chance that call was getting overturned. It was actually kind of funny listening to the broadcast too, because on the Nuggets review, it wasn't a foul and it was pretty clear. Like he got a little piece of the ball and then it's Scotty's hand that like follows through, makes contact. And they're just like, there's no way this one's getting to overturned. This one. I'm like, yeah, that's all right. Let's, I'll see you at center court for the jump ball in like 2 seconds. That's clearly not a foul. Anyway, let's keep it moving. Let's keep it rolling. We have to start with news from the personal interest from the show. So me with Gino and then Austin with Derrick Henry rumors. But let's start with Gino.
Yeah, so we started off yesterday is what we missed with some big money given out to a mediocre quarterback. And here we are again. Gino Smith and the Seahawks.
I don't know if he's a Pro Bowl.
He was
Derek
a Pro Bowl.
I'm sorry.
Derek Carzalee. In completion percentage. Yeah, so Seahawks, Gino, contract extension, 3 year, $105 million. Ability to earn $52 million in that first year. I mean, obviously that's with a lot of incentives and all that. But JD, how do you feel about locking up your quarterback of the future?
Well, I actually think that this was always going to happen, so I was pretty prepared for this. Yeah. I'll tell you right now, I root for Geno. Geno has given me an all-time Seahawks fan moment, which is beating Russell Wilson in game one back in Seattle.
Yep.
Where I almost called it Quest.
I almost called it Quest.
Yeah.
I still do that sometimes.
I had to stop myself. I was like, you beat him back at Quest. And I went, dude, don't do that.
Don't date yourself.
Don't make yourself old. Yeah, that was dangerous.
That was almost
anyway,
a date.
So I like Gino, but there is something about having, and I think you guys experienced this a little bit with the signing of Derek Carr. There is something about having the quarterback where you go, yeah, you're good to get us 10 wins, but going into the playoffs, it just, it's going to take a lot of other things around you to make it work.
Yeah.
That being said, apparently if it does get up to the $52 million, that's like 15% of the cap this season. I don't really know how this stuff works entirely, but I was looking at it and I was texting and DMing some Seahawks people that know a little bit better than me. And I don't know. It just, this is NFL money. It's always so hard to actually figure out what exactly is and isn't a bad contract.
Yeah,
to me,
like,
it's
and like, what's real money.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So to me, it seems pretty clear that Gino, this is essentially a 2 year deal.
Right.
The third year is kind of fake. It's a fake third year. they got him on a 2 year contract. That's going to be a bit more money than you probably would like to pay Gino Smith. He's no longer a bargain quarterback. That's pretty clear, especially if he hits those incentives.
Yeah.
But yeah, this team wants to be competitive. And sometimes that's frustrating. You want your organization to completely reset. But Seattle has 2 first-round picks this year and 3 second-round picks. Mm. Like, they should be absolutely loading up and moving forward with their organization in terms of adding a bunch of young talent. They hit on a few guys in the draft last year. So I'm into the direction of the team. What I think is the most interesting about this, him being 32 years old and it being essentially a 2 year contract. And then there's the buzz of they were the team that fell the most in love with Anthony Richardson. Maybe that's just smoke, but I actually kind of think that he's might be the Seahawks pick at 5.
I was about to ask about Anthony Richardson.
Yeah. I always thought maybe they would try to be in on him later in the first round if he was still around, but now it's feeling like the Richardson hype has gone completely.
Well, the combine numbers just
it's gone into hyperdrive. And frankly, I'll say this too. There's some good edge rushers in this draft, which Seattle really needs. They just need D-line help, like, desperately. Every team does. It's like there's a few things that you can just, like, never be mad at as a football fan that you draft. And it's like, if you're a Jets fan last year, you draft the number one corner with the cool name who's got, a real vibe on the
sauce.
Like, yo, this is the top corner in the draft. You go, nice.
Yeah.
Sauce.
That being said, Seattle got their top corner in, I want to say, the 6th round of the draft in Woolen. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, you can grab those guys and you can grab any position, whatever. And my point is that always feels like a cool pick when you take the top corner. It always feels like a solid but boring pick when you take the top offensive lineman, the top left tackle, you go nice. Mm-hmm. Same thing with DNs and D linemen. When you take the bona fide guys from the Alabamas and the Georgias of the world, you go, nice. This is going to be probably a very good pick. I'm probably going to really like this guy. He's been basically in a pro program now for a while.
Yeah.
Feeling pretty good about this. I think Seattle, there's just a, I think they should take a quarterback in the top five. You've got a top five pick. And the way that this draft might break, some teams might jump ahead of you. They might take Bryce. They might take C.J. Stroud.
Assuming those two are gone, though, is Richardson that I think it's
probably it's probably way too high. This is my thing. It's probably way too high. But if you're going to compete for the next bunch of years, like, when are you going to be in a position to take a talent like him again?
Right.
I think that you can get edge rushers. You can find ways to accumulate those dudes. Maybe not the top tier talent that you might end up seeing in this draft slip to them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if the situation comes down to Seattle having a crack at like Wilson or sorry, like Trayvon Walker and like this just I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I really don't want to do that.
They did get Woolen in the fifth round.
They waited
for him. Yeah.
So anyway, there's just I'd like to see them get a quarterback and groom them under Geno. This is the nice benefit of having a guy like this under 2 years. Like, that adds to the value for me. Mm. If Geno Smith, who has now become a good leader and a good locker room guy who can get the job done and teach somebody the ropes a little bit and give patience to a guy like Richardson so they don't have to rush in there,
yeah.
I think that's the way to do this pick. I'm hoping that those are the dominoes and that Seattle doesn't just decide to go like, oh, we're all going to try to win right now with Geno Smith and we're going to draft, you know, best player available that's a defensive end in that spot instead. Anyways, so it's fine. I got to tell you, Geno doesn't move me in a certain way. I think that it's like the rebound, you know, like I had a long, loving relationship with Russell Wilson. I was a huge Russell Wilson fan. And then it's hard to watch Geno Smith as good as he was last year and as much as he exceeded expectations and have me go like, this is the one.
Stick it to Russ.
It's like, anyway, that being said, I also knew when I lost Marshawn Lynch that my love of running back could never touch that. Like it just, there's something crappy about when a career is over for a guy of that ilk where you go, I'm never going to love the same way again. Like, there's just never going to be a running back that plays for the Seattle Seahawks that I like as much as I like Marshawn Lynch. 0% chance. Like, 0% chance. Who's as cool off the field, who is as big, who broke as many tackles, who had as many signature plays, who won a Super Bowl. Like, it's just, it's never going to happen. And our boy Austin Mackey is potentially dealing with the same thing. No, you don't feel that way?
Eddie George retired already, JD.
Chris Johnson
already went over 2,000 yards. You know, we've been through this mountain before.
Eddie George was cool.
I'm shocked by this take because to me, the coolest running back you can have from having Marshawn Lynch is the man among boys running back like Derrick Henry has been, who just trucks the fellas. And you go, this is a National Football League. These are the freakiest of athletes, the baddest of dudes, and you have the guy who steamrolls people. Who's the running back that's in that photo with Derrick Henry?
It's Mark Ingram, Heisman winner, good running back.
Just looking at him like,
dude, and Derrick Henry is like a legit 6'4", has cool style, runs beautifully, has been your signature player. That was kind of disrespectful, Austin. I gotta say that.
That hurt my feelings. Were more upset when Marsh retired or when Lynch left, than when Sean Alexander left.
It was not even comparable. First of all of my fantasy football team names are the Tiptoe Bandits, and it's in honor of Sean Alexander because at the end of his career, someone called him that, the Tiptoe Bandit, because that was it. He would just kind of like stutter step and then have no explosiveness left. No, dude, Sean Alexander was a good Seahawk and I liked him, but he was corny. And also he was the byproduct largely of the best offensive line in football. And when Steve Hutchinson left and went to the Minnesota Vikings in a poison pill contract, Sean Alexander was never quite the same. Plus he was in the era with LT where he just got all his excitement sapped immediately with LT breaking his record a year later. Anyway, no, I love Marsh. I would say, again, if you were doing who's JD's favorite athletes he's ever watched, Marshawn Lynch is in the top four.
Is Shaq up there too?
Shaq.
We were talking about him before the show.
Yeah, but here's the problem with Shaq. Shaq didn't play for one of my teams.
Okay,
he kind of did when I was a little kid because I definitely bought in on the Magic.
Right.
And Shaq crushed me when he went to the Lakers. I still remember learning from it, learning about it in a newspaper.
Oh.
And going, no.
No.
No, Shaquille. Anyway, I love Shaq. He's definitely one of my favorites. Like all-time personality, dominance, just enjoyability of watching. Yeah, it's very, very high. But he played for the team I hated the most in basketball, which is the Lakers. So, no, you can't have those points. But, Austin, all right, do you want to reset this thought? Like, do you want to chill out a second and show some respect to Derrick Henry?
Oh,
like,
I love Derrick Henry. And
that
I,
was Derrick not very Henry. Clear. Eddie George on your touch. You compared to the CJ2K, like, that is...
Oh, Chris Johnson had a great career, man. He was awesome. Vince Young was the quarterback then, too.
No.
I'm looking at this 2005 Sean Alexander year. 1,900 yards, 27 touchdowns. Oh, my.
That was the record. Touchdowns.
Yeah. Insane.
Yeah, that was the best. That was the
No, it's sad. And if it turns out they're trading him because they're keeping Bud Dupree and Ryan Tannehill,
Bud Dupree's already cut.
No, that was a fake rumor yesterday. That was fake news yesterday.
Fake rumor.
Yeah.
I got fake rumor.
I got too, JD. I retweeted it.
I got fake rumor.
I got. Bud Dupree's still on the roster.
You retweeted it. Austin was letting Titan Twitter know that he retweeted it. It was like, I don't know. I just think, like, if you look at Derrick Henry's career with the Titans, that one of the cool things is Offensive Player of the Year, which is the best thing that you can do as a running back because MVP is done. Did AP won MVP that 1 year, though, right?
Yeah,
he got that. That's got to be the last.
That's
running
the last
back.
Running back, non-quarterback.
Yeah, and he'll be the last one. And dude, that was insane that year he had. Like, but yeah, I don't know. I think Derrick Henry goes into the category of like signature running backs of this era. And people thought that he would age really poorly, and maybe the Titans are getting off of him now because they feel like they've given him too many carries. But you know, he led the league in rushing in terms of like attempts 3 different times. Like 3 times already with a guy that's that size with that physicality that he's held up this way has been pretty shocking. Anyway, I love Derrick Henry. He's always a guy that I wish I owned in fantasy, but I never have had the auction dollars to do it. And he's also one of those guys where every year I feel like someone does get a decent bargain on him recently because there is that, hey, he's going to wear down. He's still just the identity to be the identity player of an offense as a running back in this modern era is so impressive to me. So anyway, be careful what you say, Austin, all right?
I do not want them to trade Derrick Henry.
No,
I'm saying about that.
I'm saying that CJ2K having a burner who is sick, you're more likely to see a CJ2K again in your life or an Eddie George than you're never going to see another Derrick Henry on your team. Like, you're never going to get that. Like, these guys are the rarest, most fun dudes to have. They're so fun that I remember the guys that were just okay at it for a little while. Like, Brandon Jacobs. Remember that?
Sat up when he was six seconds old.
Yeah, and it was just, hey, Brandon Jacobs, he's getting the rock inside the five, and he's going in. You know, Marion Barber, R.I.P.
Marion Barber.
Who also did that, like, kind of halfway decent, was the bruiser back. That's why when you get the elite man-crusher running back who just runs people over, I don't think there's a sweeter thing to have in all of football. I don't think, like, from an aesthetically pleasing standpoint for me, I'd rather have that, the Marshawn Lynch, than the quarterback who's nasty just from, like, a watching experience. Not a win a championship, duh, that's not the case I'm making. But to me, the most enjoyable thing is when you can have the running back that they hand the rock to and they say, yep, we're giving it to you first, second down all the time, and this guy is just chunk playing and steamrolling. Like
putting a stiff arm like through someone's face mask.
Yeah, I remember the Beastquake more than I'm just saying the Beastquake means straight up almost as much to me as the Super Bowl win. The Super Bowl win, I'm not even kidding. First of all, beating the Niners is more important than the Super Bowl. The Niners game and the Richard Sherman tip is like the way that I remember that run more than anything. Like that's the signature play. Beating the Niners was the Super Bowl. Those are the two best teams. The Super Bowl kind of stunk for me as a Seahawks fan.
True.
Losing one also took away from the joy of that because of the way they lost. And I know people don't believe that, but it's true. Like it just, the way they lost in such horrific fashion almost erased the Super Bowl victory. The only thing that Seahawks fans have is that. But yes, from aesthetic standpoint, like, yeah, the Beastquake to me, that is the most important play to me in football history. Like personally, more than any play, more than even, it's that or the Richard Sherman tip. One of the two.
I mean, those are two pretty good options,
yeah,
to be fair.
I'm saying, what was your favorite Derrick Henry run? You have one that comes to mind when you think about him?
Oh, yeah. I want to say week 14, 2018, Thursday night game against the Jacksonville Jaguars. DeMarco Murray was out.
That was his first, he emerged.
I think he had 200-something yards that game, but it was first play of the game, 60 yards right down like a bolt of lightning.
That was incredible.
Yeah. Was Jerome Bettis the best version of the guy you're talking about right now? Who, in your opinion, is like the best version of the guy who just runs everybody over?
Marshawn. Well, I mean,
no, the longest, because Marshawn's
probably Jim Brown, it's definitely like an older running. It's definitely not Jerome. Jerome Bettis, straight up the most overrated running back in NFL history.
Really?
Oh my God, yeah, dude. I watched Jerome Bettis' career. He was good. He was
Hall of very good.
Yeah, very overrated. Ooh. Amazing. That's how far branding goes for somebody.
The bus.
The bus was more of like a hard to bring down guy than a like beast freak who was like crushing dudes. No. Derrick Henry and Marshawn Lynch are not in that category. Like Marshawn, he's a short yardage back, like somebody who could pick that up. He had more wiggle to him based on like his body type. I liked Jerome Bettis too. Don't get me wrong. He kind of ruined it because again, they took a Super Bowl from me too, which I was a big Bettis guy. And I actually used to kind of like the Steelers before that. Jerome Bettis was not ripping down the field, running over eight guys. And they were like, what a physical freak. We can never touch this dude. Like, no, Austin, he is not the best at it. He is absolutely not the best at it.
I was tricked by the marketing.
Anyways, yes, you were. You're too young for that. You're just outside the zone. Anyway. All right. Let's hit some stories. What do we got? Oh, we ran out of time. We talked a lot.
We talked a lot today.
Yeah.
Did you want to get to the shopping cart thing quickly or?
Yeah, quick. Let's do that.
Okay,
so
essentially the shopping cart trend is resurfaced on the internet recently, and it's basically the idea of if you return a shopping cart to the store, carousel, whatever it is, it basically decides if you're a good person or not and whether you're capable of self-governing.
Right after that, you just go over, murder someone in cold blood.
That's the thing. If you return the shopping cart, good person, you don't, psychotic.
Yeah.
So I want to know, what other everyday things do you think decide a person's morality?
First of all, the shopping cart one,
pretty good.
I think it's overrated, though.
Really?
Yeah, because I think there's places that you can leave it that it's not that bad. Like, if you leave it in a busy parking lot, like...
Just in the middle?
Yeah, you're scum. You're scum.
100%.
But if you're doing it where, like, you're in an old... I don't want to say old, but like a big, wide, vast, abandoned lot where there's a ton of space and you're kind of far...
I mean, okay, if it's in the middle of nowhere, then I guess.
No, I'm just saying, like, we all know those multiplexes or whatever that have kind of died out over time.
True.
And it's like, if you're going like late at night or doing something like that and you're just loading up and you want to get done, it's cold outside, whatever. It's like, yeah, those are employees. They can kind of grab stuff. It's like Donovan Bennett used to tell me, like, he throws out everything that when he goes to a baseball game, he takes like all his garbage up. Like, he's very clean in his area at the stadium. And I'm like, no, that's not. I think that. It's fine to be kind of messy in your seats at a stadium. I'm kind of a little bit more like that with the shopping cart. I think the overrated one is servers, where people say, oh, are you mean to servers? It's like, no person in their right mind is like snapping their fingers
that's
at servers.
That's what I was going to bring up because I knew you were going to love it.
But that's what I'm saying. But it's like, it's gone too far where, yeah, clearly if you are rude to a server unjustified, that's a really bad personality trait.
Yes.
But I do think that there actually is like, we've gone so far with it that, damn, we should have left more time for this. We're going to have to come back for this.
Yeah,
we're going to have to come back for this because Austin's like 20 my year. Subscribe to this podcast.
Put a pin in this.
Yeah, we'll do this more later. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Be kind. And put your shopping carts back. We'll talk to you tomorrow. 3